Welcome to our Rough of the Passer podcast, the post-wildcard weekend, pre-divisional playoff weekend podcast. I'm Pete Prisco, and Brady Quinn and Pat Curran are with me. What's up, guys?
What's going on?
We're doing great, Pete. All the road teams won, Pete. All the inexperienced quarterbacks lost.
Well, we know that, right? It's a quarterback league. We say that all the time, and it just shows up, particularly in the postseason. But I want to start with the kicker. Does he deserve all the criticism that he's getting, or the fact that he made three field goals to keep him in the game and Adrian Peterson fumbled is kind of, I mean, yes, he should have made the kick, but is he taking too much heat?
Well, there's history there in Minnesota, right? We had a guy miss the only kick of the year and they lost to the Falcons and didn't go to the Super Bowl. So there was a haunting message, but, Brady, I'm going to assume you were a holder at some point in your life. Those laces were facing the kicker. You can't do that.
That's one of the biggest things to overcome. And from playing and growing up in cold weather games, whether it was in South Bend where I held a little bit or Cleveland, one of the toughest things to do as a holder is trying to spin the football appropriately when you have gloves on because they're a little bit stickier. And a lot of times you don't practice that quite as much. Now, I would assume that Jeff Locke has at some point, considering that they play in Minnesota, they have all that time throughout practice to be able to practice with gloves on, with gloves off, catching the football, getting it down and spinning it. So that definitely plays a factor for the holder standpoint. So he should have found some sort of way to not give Blair Walsh the laces. And for people who don't understand, it not only affects the kick, in which it didn't affect his first kick that he made from 47 yards because he actually kicked under the laces. If you look at the point at which his foot contacted the ball, he swept underneath and was able to get the ball up with enough distance to get it through. So it didn't affect the direction of the kick. The next one, he kicked it more on the laces and it actually blasted it. And that's why I kind of took that left hook pretty hard past the left upright. And it has a lot to do with a kicker seeing the laces. It kind of freaks you out. It gets them off of their focus as far as the point at which they want to contact the football in. And I don't think Blair Walsh should be getting as much criticism as he is. I mean, he was one of the reasons why they were even in that game in the first place with his previous three kicks. And on top of that, it's no gimme in particular in those weather, in those conditions when it is that cold outside, the balls are that hard and you've got a lot of different things you're dealing with.
Yeah, I think he choked. I mean, his kicking coach in South Florida is a guy I've known since he was a kid, Nick Gattitano, who once was a kicker at Penn State, a pretty good one. But, I mean, look, the guy made his kicks, but you got him. 99%, you got to make that. I mean, you have to make that. So, the other thing, too, is there's no crying in football. You can't cry in the locker room. That one bothered me a little bit. I'm a hard, hard man, I guess, but I don't think you should sit it. Look, he answered all the questions. I give him all the credit in the world, but you can't cry.
He wasn't alone crying. Believe me.
Well, I mean, you think the players were crying?
There were players crying. Guys take it serious, Pete. It, for the guy who's the 29-year-old veteran who's never been in that position, who's finally in it, he saw his life's dreams fall apart in front of him. But let's go back to Adrian Peterson.
I'm a stubborn guy with that. I don't think you should ever cry in football unless you're hurt to the point where you got to cry. I mean, win or losing shouldn't be a crying thing to me. I don't know. That's the way I've always been. I've never been a guy that cried over winning.
Well, that doesn't make it wrong for the guy who can't help his emotions. I mean, I didn't cry when we lost games. We lost to the Houston Oilers in a playoff game that we on a last blitz and the guy missed and we lost and we didn't move on. I didn't cry, but I saw guys in the locker room that were crushed. Crushed by it. The guy who missed the sack, he was crushed by it. The coach, there was a coach who was upset with the blitz call he made. I get it. I'm sure Brady's been around some crying. So I don't judge that as good or bad. That's how some people let their emotions out.
Yeah, I think, Pat, you're onto something. And, Pete, you have to understand, these aren't all grown men. Your brain doesn't fully stop developing until the average age of 25. And that's typically now the average age of a lot of NFL teams. It's seldom you find, older NFL teams. And I think you look at the way you know, these players put their heart and soul and effort into everything and how physical these games are, it becomes extremely emotional, man, because at this point in the season, a lot of guys are playing banged up. They're giving it their all, and it's physically and emotionally exhausting to be able to do all you can to get to a certain point and to have one play, if you want to put it on that, change the course of the direction for that team. Look, to me, when I saw tears from guys, when I saw guys who had broke down like that, regardless of age, it just reminded me of how much the game means to them, how passionate they were about their job and how much physical exertion that they had put in, not only in the course of the game or the week of preparation, but throughout the entire season to get to this point, because it really is a new team each year in the NFL with how much turnover there is on rosters. So it's a saddening time. It's an exhausting time. And sometimes that's how people like to display their emotions, man. They can't help it. It means too much to them.
You know, did you ever cry over winning and losing, Brady?
I did in college. I can't recall a specific time in the NFL. But again, I mean, you go back to the Fiesta Bowl. We lost that game my junior year. Yeah. I was a mess in the locker room afterwards because of a couple things. One, I didn't necessarily know if I was going to be coming back for my senior year. And I didn't want to end my career on a losing note. Two, we were going up against the team that was 20 minutes away from where I grew up. And it meant everything in the world to me to be able to go in there and get a win so I could walk back with pride back into my hometown, back into all that in front of all those fans who, you know, may have supported me growing up. But the second you go to Notre Dame or you go somewhere else besides Ohio State, all of a sudden it turns very vicious in the way people handle things. So of course, man, I mean, it was a game where things didn't go the way we wanted to. And you look at the efforts of our team and all that and the bond that we had, we really wanted to kind of put a cap on a season that meant a ton to us. And to me personally, that game meant everything.
Let me give the other side of the coin, because I learned this in pro football and it was weird when I first got in the league. The other side of this whole coin is I was around some devastating losses on the road, and we got back on the plane, and some of the guys I knew loved football, took it very serious, wanted to be great. They'd be in the back playing cards afterwards and having a laugh with their friends. At first, I didn't understand, but then I came over time to understand I can't judge anybody for how they're going to deal with a defeat. I can't look at those guys and go, they didn't care today. And we had guys that coaches that would look at them and say, oh, those guys don't care. Yeah, they care. They're just not going to show you how they care, the same as the guy who's crying in his beer. So I think you got to be careful, in my opinion, of judging any emotion after a game that you know what it means.
Yeah, and look, I get it. Look, people, they express themselves in different ways. I just was never one personally that I don't understand. For me, it's hard to grasp the concept of crying over a game, and it always has been. I'm talking about dating since I was a kid. I just, look, you go out, you do your job, boom, whatever you do, and you move on. And yes, you know what's sad? You know, Brady, when you were done at Notre Dame, that's sad. You're leaving guys, your guys you're with, and I understand that. And there's a bond there, and that's the sad part of it. Or if somebody brings you back and honors your team together and for what you did, then I could see that maybe bringing out emotion or a Hall of Fame induction or something. I never quite grasped the idea of crying after a game. And Pat, if I had been in the NFL, I'd have probably been that guy in the back playing cards after the game, even though it would have burned my butt to lose the football game.
There it is. And so I think it was a good question, because we all observe other people's behavior and make conclusions about what it means. And sometimes I think it's a mistake, especially in personnel. If you start looking at guys going, okay, that guy doesn't care, he's just playing for the cash and all that business. I think you got to be really careful. I do anyway, about how you look at those things. And I learned the hard way, because I couldn't stand it the first three or four times I was on a plane watching these guys just chill out and get their card game going. Then I saw coaches who I knew were really into it, playing in the card game. Then I go, man, I gotta stop doing that.
You know what it reminds me of? The obligatory face in the elevator by the coaching staff after a loss. And you know what I'm talking about. They always hold the elevator for the coaches in the press box after a game. And if the team loses, you could know a guy for 25 years and laugh with him and goof with him and drink with him and whatever. And he gets on that elevator with all his other buddies after a loss, and every single one of them has the same obligatory, I'm miserable face. You know what I'm talking about, right, Pat, Brady?
Yeah, but I don't think it's fake. I think they know exactly what a loss does. It's a 10-game losing streak in baseball. It's a step closer to being fired. It's a, an incredible amount of hours of work, players and coaches combined, which added up to a loss. I get why they're, and I don't think it's fake. I just think they're mortified by it.
Yeah, but they're also afraid that if they said, hey, what's up or something, you know, then they go back to your old theory on they don't care enough.
Well, I don't know, Brady, you've been around guys. I don't like screamers after the game. I don't like guys yelling, you guys, you know, played like crap. I don't like any of that stuff. I think steady, even keel is the way it is. I think you got to – now, Pete Carroll's guys, as an example, you know, they lucked out. But he's got to get them back to earth for the next one. They can't be walking around like you did something good. That film today is going to show a lot of things that have to be fixed.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see if the Seattle Seahawks can kind of realize that, you know, they're very fortunate to have the opportunity to be even going to Carolina to play in a playoff game. But also in the same breath, that makes them kind of dangerous to me because, you know, it could be that lucky warning sign that they get. You know, we talk about sometimes teams like the Carolina Panthers who went 15-1. Well, that one loss may have been meaningful in the sense that, you know, they didn't feel as if they were, you know, unbeatable. You know, they understand like where their weaknesses are. They understand what the things they need to do to try to improve on over the course of the time their bye week heading into the divisional round. So, you know, people have talked about maybe that was the best thing that happened to them, them dropping a game this season and not going 16-0 entering the playoffs. Maybe this is the best thing that could have happened for the Seattle Seahawks. Being able to play not very well, but still manage to find a way to get to the divisional round. And who knows what happens from here.
Let me ask you guys this. The fact that Walsh missed the kick, doesn't that kind of take some of the heat away from Adrian Peterson?
You can make the same case, though, with not only Peterson, but Jeremy Hill. Everyone wants to blame, you know, the defense, whether it's Pac-Man Jones or Vontez Perfect, who, by the way, Perfect and Jones in the return game, but Perfect defensively had a heck of a game. I mean, the sack on Roethlisberger that ended up taking him out of the game, and then the interception late as well. Without those two plays, I don't even know if Cincinnati is in the ball game quite as much, considering what, you know, what they meant. So, you know, everyone kind of takes some of the blame off of Jeremy Hill. But I'll go even a step further, Pete. And Pat, don't you guys feel like if it's an interception, like if that was Andy Dalton throwing that interception that cost the Bengals the game essentially, or the Minnesota Vikings, if it was Teddy Bridgewater, don't you feel like they would have received more blame than the running backs do in this case? I feel like the running backs, for whatever reason, they kind of get the slide under the radar.
I agree. Now, Bill Parcells wouldn't give him a slide. He'd tell him to get the heck out of the game. You know, I was thinking about what you said, Brady. When the game happened, I go, you know, if Andy was in this game, first off, if he played the way he played in 2015, they're going to win the game. Number two, if he threw that pick, that guy would be in unbelievable devastation right now, and the ridicule on him would be brutal. So I'm with you. I think the running backs both look right before both fumbles. I think everyone watching who knows anything about football said these defenses are going to try to rip the ball out. That's what they're down to. And these running backs, what's with them? Go down with the ball. Know when it's over. And anytime you're trying to fight for a half inch in those situations, you're just giving them an extra chance to rip the ball out. I don't get the running backs. They get a free pass in my mind, and they should.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And you know what else, too, is, you know, now you've transitioned. Okay, Peterson got a pass, and he shouldn't have. And there were a variety of reasons for that game the way it happened. Let's move to the Bengals game. You got, because I was at that game. And did you guys notice a couple things? Perfect running up the tunnel with its teammates after the interception was ridiculous and should have been flagged. And that just shows you a lack of discipline on that team right now. And two, you know, Jeremy Hill, I don't know if you guys can see it on TV, but he was doing some kind of dance on the sidelines the entire time after that interception. And the next play he went back in there was when he fumbled. I mean, they're so undisciplined. It's unbelievable to me. That was ridiculous Saturday night. And Marvin Lewis has to tighten the reins. He has to bring those guys in. They're running amok there.
And they're prideful that they're better now than they ever were. So there's an interesting perspective. Back in the days of Chad and those guys, it was apparently way worse. And it was one of the things Carson Palmer said he couldn't take anymore. And he wanted out. Couple things. Our reporter on the sideline, Tracy, I mean, seconds before Vontaze went back in the game, said he's on the sideline out of control. You know, the head coach has to grab him. And let me just say, Bill Cowher is very close friends with Marvin Lewis. They're high school buddies. But he actually said at the end of the game, the head coach is responsible for that behavior. And you should have held the guy until he got his emotions under control. Because Brady's right. He played a great game. But he also, it was like the double-edged sword with him. What he gives you, he takes away himself. You got to sometimes just got to hold the guy. I don't care if it's one play and go, get your act together, man. Before I send you back out there, get under control.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Go ahead, Brady. You know that team very well. I mean, your brother-in-law plays on that team.
Yeah, but I think that's part of the culture there, though. I think everyone looks at the Brown family as this organization and this ownership that they can bring in some guys who have some issues and have some things in their past and be able to help rehabilitate them, if you want to go that far, but really help them be able to achieve their goals on the football field, but also in life as a person outside of it. And I think we're just still seeing, you know, a guy in Vontaze Perfect who's trying to mature, who's trying to continue to grow. If I'm not mistaken, he's only 25 years old, and that goes to show you he's, again, right around that age where, you know, and Pete Carroll talked about this when we were at the Seattle Seahawks, you know, your brain's not fully developed yet. Like, as far as understanding the value and understanding the you know, how important the game is and the different decisions that you make on and off the field are, you fully don't comprehend that and understand the risks involved sometimes with the decisions that you make. And I think he's still trying to figure that out. You know, the NFL is trying to help him out by fining him for some of the hits that he makes. But obviously, maybe they need to increase that. Maybe that'll help him come to the realization that he cannot continue to play this way. If one, he wants to continue to play and not get penalized, but two, wants to make more money. I mean, this is a guy who's been undrafted because of some of his history coming into the league. So, you know, look, again, this has been the culture of the Bengals. They feel like they can bring these guys in, get the most out of them of a player, and help them as a person. I just think it sometimes takes a little bit more time. Clearly, in his case, or in Perfect's case, you know, they're still working on that. And that's how some teams work. You see others where there's a zero tolerance policy and those guys aren't playing the following season. You see others that understand, no different than, you know, Greg Hardy and the Cowboys and Jerry Jones signing him, right? They understood what they were bringing onto their team, but the talent trumped, you know, the moral character of that particular player. I think in this particular case, they understand how good Perfect is.
Yeah, but okay. That's all. Well, look, the penalties on the field, that you can, the league can remedy that by fining them. You can rein them in a little bit, but it's more than that. And it just being in that locker room after the game and talking to guys I know on that team, and there's a real divide of players on that team who do it the right way, who are tired of those guys doing it their way. And not just on the field. It's in the locker room. It's constant griping and moaning, and you blew that coverage, and they're screaming at each other, and it's disrespecting, you know, people in the locker room that work there and everything. I mean, it's just out of control, and that lies on Marvin Lewis. I like Marvin. I like Marvin a great deal. People say, oh, he's 0-7 in the playoff. This was one of his best teams. He didn't have his quarterback. You don't get rid of a guy for that. But Marvin Lewis has to tighten the reins on this team. There's too much talent there, and they're letting it go to waste by the dumb, stupid way that they play, A, and B, their looseness and their brashness and the way they handle themselves in the locker room.
I agree, and you might be down to the point of, we got to get rid of them. You just got to get rid of guys. And the idea that you can change them. You know what? You know when it surfaces? It surfaces in the biggest moment, which you're not really prepared for during a summer camp practice or a September game. Even Pac-Man had a hard time controlling his emotions. But I will say this on a positive note, and I wanted to get this out today. Even though they lost, I thought Teddy Bridgewater, A.J. McCarron, and Kirk Cousins really showed me, anyway, there's a great future with these guys. You can win with these guys. They're going to be fine. They're going to win playoff games. I was pretty excited about all three guys, and I was hoping you guys would have an opinion, whether it's the same as mine or not, doesn't matter. But I when those games ended, I wrote a note on all three guys. I didn't write one for Hoyer, but those three kids, I saw a lot of brightness.
Yeah, you know me. Look, Cousins, I'm okay with that one. You give him a contract, and but you got to be careful with it. You got to go nuts with it, because I still think you give him a contract for the long run. You give him, you know, $17, $18 million a year. Somewhere down the road, you may regret that. But you give
him
a contract.
Can I throw in a stat to that, by the way, Pete, if you don't mind? And Pat, I'm curious to see how you'll evaluate this stat. I'm sure you guys have seen it. It's been out there. Of 26 career starts for Kirk Cousins, he has zero wins versus teams with winning records.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. But he did, but Brady, to Pat's point, he did do some good things yesterday. He was a little off on some throws, though. There was a key throw on the sideline. He was off. His accuracy wasn't as good, but I understand that one. Teddy, to me, at the end of the game, it's hard to evaluate anybody in that mess because it's hard to, as you know, Brady, you played it. It's hard to throw the football in that situation, but to make those throws when he made them, I didn't think he had that in him. So Pat, I'll give you that one. The other one, you know, I thought McCarron was god awful for three quarters.
Well, I look at McCarron different. I don't see him as the starter. He's the backup. And
right. I'll give you that.
I got like, wow, this guy can come off the bench and play. And I felt that way for the last 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, I'd say that too. I mean, but if you're like a team like, if say you're a team like the Texans, they just saw Brian Hoyer have an implosion. He became who he was. You are what you are. Do they make it, like, is McCarron the kind of guy you wouldn't mind getting to be your starting quarterback?
Well, I'll tell you what I would do. I'd be going after Cousins if I was Houston.
Yeah, but aren't they going to re-sign him there? And
how are they going to do it? I've been saying this for a month. He's not good enough to franchise tag him. You're not going to be able to hold him. If there's going to be people out there talking to that agent today. I promise you.
You know, it's curious. I think you look at the Texans, you talk about that scenario, by the way. I mean, there's obviously ties to a kid coming out in the draft this year. I'll be curious to see, because he hasn't had a great college career since Bill O'Brien left the Penn State, but that's Christian Hackenberg. I mean, a guy who has all the tools and fundamentals. I know we're talking about Cousins in this case, but if you're talking about, you know, looking forward and looking for quarterbacks, a lot of these teams might look to the draft because there's definitely some players who are available, whether or not how they evaluate them and they look at their success over the course of this year, their college career is another thing. But Hackenberg's a guy who Bill O'Brien orchestrated in getting to go to Penn State. He sees the strong arm. He sees, you know, the prototypical size that you'd like out of a kid who took a beating at times but was able to play through it. I'll be curious to see if the Houston Texans don't go that route, as well as, you know, if you look at the Washington Redskins, depending on what kind of offer they give Kirk Cousins. But I mean, but here's the thing. I mean, you mentioned the Houston Texans as one of the teams that maybe would look at a Kirk Cousins and want to bring him in. Who else, though, Pat and Pete? I mean, like, who else Cleveland. Are you looking at? I mean, does Kirk want to go to Cleveland? Is he going to be the next quarterback up there?
Yeah.
There are some scenarios, too, that I think the grass might not be greener if Kirk starts looking elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't think Kirk wants to look elsewhere, but economics is funny. And God we trust. You know, people that are starved for quarterback, Houston, Cleveland as examples, they're going to look at the draft class, and they're going to look at Kirk Cousins, and they're going to like what they see, I think. So, and I only say that because Washington's going to have to pay way more than they thought to keep him. He's not doing a discount deal, because a team like Houston, if I was a Houston GM, I could sell Houston to Kirk Cousins. Look at our defense. Look at DeAndre Hopkins. You know, I could give him a lot of things that might make him feel, oh, that's right, no state income tax. We're going to give you a big bonus.
Yeah, I mean, I still
sell Houston to that kid.
I'm still a little, you know me, I'm a little hesitant on Kirk Cousins. And I get you pay him, but you got to be careful what you pay him. He isn't a top 15 quarterback. He's, you know, maybe 16, 17, or 18. And yet, if you have to pay him, Pat, you're going to end up, what, paying him like a 10?
Well, let me ask you this, the reality check question. Well, if you don't pay him, what are you doing?
I know. Isn't that what happened in Miami?
Yeah. Look, these quarterbacks get leverage pretty quick. And it's not because they're great. It's because they're okay.
Right.
And that's
but
dangerous.
Is that worked out for Miami? If you're Miami, because I know you've been critical of Tannehill. Is that something that they should have done? Because it's kind of facing the same situation with Kirk Cousins now.
I agree with that. Brady's the guy to ask. Brady, compare Tannehill, because this guy's going to expect more money than Tannehill because he just went to the playoffs. You compare them. You tell me who's a better prospect for the 2016 and beyond.
Yeah, and it's so hard for me to make a comparison between the two, only because I look at Kirk Cousins and you look, I throw the stat of the 26 career starts on zero wins versus a winning team. But that being said, Ryan Tannehill has a much greater body of work. And I think you look at the two and you maybe say to yourself, well, we kind of feel like Ryan Tannehill is maybe what he is as a quarterback at this point in the league. We can help get him more protection up front, which would greatly help him, not only from getting some protection, so he's not getting just crushed week in and week out, and providing him more time in the pocket, but also to help with more of a running game, at least a consistent running game. And then you see if you can continue to build out around him, maybe Adam Gase brings in a system that works to his strengths, not his weaknesses, and that helps improve his play. In the case of Kirk Cousins, I think he could be a guy that you're looking at and saying, he's still an ascending player. He had a great season this year, led the league in completion percentage, and maybe this is just the beginning of a guy who's going to continue to improve and get better as the team improves and gets better. So I don't know that. I think economically speaking, he's probably going to look at trying to get some sort of contract that would be in the ballpark of Ryan Tannehill. And maybe the lack of experience will hurt him in that case. Maybe the success this year will help him. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But I think as far as, you know, pairing the two against one another, they're pretty comparable in a bunch of different ways. I'd say maybe Kirk Cousins is a bit more accurate from what I've seen, but Ryan Tannehill is more athletic. I think he's shown to be a bit more durable. And that being said, probably has a little bit stronger arm. But in the end, you know, it's pretty tough to say which one would be better than the other. I think they both have a bright future. Maybe Tannehill more because of the scenarios and now with all the talent around him and a head coach who I assume took the job pitching the fact that he can help improve Ryan Tannehill's play, no different than what he did with Jay Cutler in Chicago. And with Kirk Cousins, I don't know. I mean, if he goes somewhere else besides the Washington Redskins, I would be a little bit concerned to see what he's going to be able to do or what the future of his career looks like, because he can't use the foundation he built in Washington with the wide receivers and some of his different targets, but also with Jay Gruden's system and everything else. He's not going to be able to continue to build off of that. He's going to have to start over again. And I think that's when you sometimes can get into trouble. I think Ryan Tannehill is going to run a system that will be somewhat similar in the sense of maybe no huddle, having more control at the line of scrimmage and the being able to do things that'll play to his strengths, as opposed to just running a system that Bill Lazor wanted in the past. So I don't know. It's kind of tough to pit these two against one another. I think they both could have bright futures, but they each need some help around them in order to ensure their success.
Hey, Pat, I want to put your GM hat on.
Yeah.
The Texans just won the division, made the postseason, got whacked in the postseason, and now moving forward, would you rather be the Texans, the Jaguars, the Titans, the Colts? Rank them in order, because I know my answer. I'd put the Texans.
I'd like to be the Colts. That's
right.
Andrews.
Number one.
And I'd like to be Jacksonville second, but maybe third. It's a really debate between them and Tennessee. Because, look, here we go. We had the experienced quarterbacks go on the road and beat all of the inexperienced guys at home yesterday. And now we're going to talk about the next phase of games and what is surfacing. You start looking at these games, and you're looking at guys with an awful lot of playoff experience, so it takes time to be good. And you've said it all fall, and I've never challenged it. Houston doesn't have a quarterback. So as nice as the defense is, there's no one that can pull the trigger on the ball. So I put Houston fourth, to tell you the truth, if you're asking me about 2016 and beyond. And I like Christian Hackenberg, and I do think they'll draft him. And they're going to draft 21st. He'll be available because of how poorly he's played in the last 2 years. But that Franklin offense was awful for him. I talked to one of the guys who left Penn State early last year, and he said he felt bad for Christian that he had to stay because there was he couldn't escape yet. But the reality is that offense hurt him, and I think Houston, I don't know how Houston would pass on the guy, to tell you the truth, if they get a shot at him. But, I mean, I like where Bortles is and probably have to put Mariota slightly behind him. Look, Bortles threw the living daylights out of the ball this year, and I like his weapons. So Jacksonville 2, Tennessee 3, Houston 4. Now, I'm sure one of you guys or both of you disagree with my order, but that would be mine.
Oh, I agree with you. I think your order's right. I think it's Colts 1 because of Luck, Jacksonville 2 because of Bortles, 3 for Mariota, And I'll be honest with you, I think, despite all the talent they have on defense, I think the Texans are way behind unless they solve that quarterback position. And that's going to be hard to do in a year.
Well, this is one of the reasons I brought up, and Cousin, I'm sure we'll get on to another subject here, but if you're the GM, or in this case, the head coach, you're looking at the timing of everything. You can't, as much as you might like Kristen Hackenberg, you got to be saying, if I take that guy and play him, I'm talking about 2 years before he's ready to be anything and 3 years before he wins a playoff game. And by then, some of these guys that I like on my football team, the timing's off. That's why sometimes if you can find a Cousins, you know, you're much closer to bringing it all together and making it peak at once.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. This might be one of the only scenarios if you're looking at the situation as a quarterback that you really have to evaluate actually the defense. And when you look at the Texans, they have such a dominant defense that at times, I think if whether you're a free agent quarterback or you're a prospect who's looking at being drafted, you'd have to like the ability to be able to walk into a scenario where you can make mistakes, you can afford to make mistakes, and you could still be in ball games because that defense is going to get you the ball back. They're going to put you in good field position and be in advantageous positions. And it's just rare. Usually a lot of quarterbacks kind of look at least when you're a free agent or you're coming out of college, you're sitting there thinking, okay, who are my weapons? Who do I have to throw to? What's my protection look like? A running game, a system. In this case, I mean, I think you've got the system you want. You've got a nice offensive mind in Bill O'Brien. You've got a wide receiver in Hopkins, and obviously they're going to commit to the run game, which is good, but it's that defense too that would really be attractive to me is saying, man, this is a great team that I'm going to get better at, you know, because I'm going to continue to practice against one of the best defenses in the league, but also on the flip side of that, they're going to help me out when it comes game day.
You know, Brady, I got to ask you, the other part, and this will be a follow-up. The head coach is a quarterback coach himself with credentials, so that's intriguing to me. But the other part is I'm looking at guys like Hopkins. Hopkins caught passes from four guys, Hoyer, Mallett, Yates, and Whedon, and they couldn't stop the guy. Like, that kid alone intrigues me. So, I could make the case for recruiting him because does Bill O'Brien really have the time to get 3 years to develop? That owner looks too itchy to win. I'd be inclined to be looking for someone ready to go.
Yeah, and that's probably maybe the best way of looking at it as well, right? As far as, you know, moving forward, you know, what he's kind of looking at to get them over the hump. I'm curious to see if they don't try to make a play for someone, but it's funny just to see the success that they were able to at least have. And a lot of that has to do obviously with Andrew Luck being injured and the Colts not living up to expectations. Pete, you've said this for a number of weeks now, right? I mean, this isn't going to be the case for the Texans moving forward until they do get a quarterback, because once the Colts come back with Andrew Luck, and now that they've kind of, I guess, at least for the time being, it seems like everyone's friends in the front office, and with Chuck Pagano and Ryan Grigson and Jim Irsay, everyone's back on the same page. It seems like they're really back in a position once they get healthy to make a run for that AFC South for quite some time. But I guess I shouldn't overlook
too. Jacksonville will win that division next year.
So now you're saying Jacksonville. Now, yet you talk about in the past.
I would rank Indy one because I always rank the quarterback one. I always went, and he's the best. He's the best.
Okay, then Jacksonville's the number two team you're seeing.
Yep. Jacksonville will win the division next year because they're going to go out and spend $60 million on I don't know what, but they're going to try and spend it and get two or three, four different defensive players. They're going to draft defensive players. They're going to get Fowler back. They're going to get Marks back. They're going to be much better on defense. And offensively, that's a young group that's only going to get better. I mean, they got to shore up the line a little bit, particularly in the middle Wisniewski will be gone. They'll get a new center. But that team, when they get Linder back, their guards are going to be good. They're going to win a division next year.
Huh.
Yes, I just wrote that down, Pete.
You write it down. Now, can I play general manager in Jacksonville? Because I could fix the defense for them if they let me.
Well, we're going to let you.
I go get Weddle. That would be first and foremost because they need somebody that can play, you know, in coverage and can line people up back there. And he's got three by the time – this staff and this regime is going to be out if they don't win now. So he'll be good for him in the next two or three years. So go get him. Make a run at Norman if he's out there. I don't think he will be, but make a run at him. If not, go get Janoris Jenkins, somebody like that. Get another corner. And then, you know, whatever guys, Malik Jackson, Danny Trevathan, those guys on the Denver defense, you know, Von Miller came free. Go get those guys. Go get some speed. Go get some big guys. You know, Olivier Vernon, Bruce Irvin, bring a nasty. I think Bruce Irvin, you know, he's not a great player, but he's nasty. When you watch Seattle play, Bruce Irvin is nasty. That's what Jacksonville needs. And, you know, you fix it, then draft some defensive guys, and off you go.
I don't blame that plan at all. I wouldn't criticize it either. The weapons on offense, they look to me like a team that can score 25 points a game. The defensive-minded head coach knows Bruce Irvin better than anybody. So, yeah, I don't disagree with what your thoughts are there. I will say this. Be careful how many veterans you bring in for a lot of money, because the first thing you're going to do, this will go right to Brady, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to overpay someone, and your guys on your roster that are working their way up the ladder are going to have their nose out of shape. They're going to be bent and pissed when they see what you bring into the locker room and what you pay them. If you don't pay your own guys,
yeah, but
first.
They're so young though, Pat, that might not even be an it, you know, because most of those guys aren't even eligible for new deals yet.
Yeah, that's true. It's a different.
Hey, I want to talk about the Packers real quick.
Good.
You know, we've talked a lot about the quarter teams that went out with the quarterbacks, or whatever, but the Packers are moving on, and you know, for a quarter of that game, you sat there and you go, okay, this is the same old thing, and then you notice that thing started going to the line of scrimmage, and they played faster. And they were more up-tempo. And, you know, to me, it looked like Rodgers started being Rodgers again because he was loose and free and throwing balls into tight spaces and everything else, all because they started playing faster. And they turned it over to him. That's how they have to play, right? I mean, that's who they are.
I didn't really see it the same way, though, Pete. I mean, like they've played with tempo at times this year. I don't think that was the case. I think they're just playing an inferior defense in the Redskins. I mean, look, let's be honest. Of any of the teams playing in the wild card weekend, I mean, I think most of us probably looked at that matchup with the Redskins and thought that's probably one of the weaker teams, in part because people maybe didn't believe in Kirk Cousins and what he'd be able to do in the playoffs, but also their defense. They were the most lacking defense of any of those teams in wild card weekend. So that being the case, we knew it was going to be easy pickings for the Green Bay Packers because they were going to have the matchups they wanted to outside, guys being able to get separation, provide protection up front. And I think because they passed early, it helped open up the run game there in the second half, in particular when they built a lead. I mean, that's why, to me, you know, we didn't see the running game early because the Packers weren't ahead. They had to get up ahead in order to then possess the ball, own that time position, and run the football. And that's what we saw. Once they were able to kind of get over the hump initially of, putting their left tackle in a position to be one-on-one and formatting some things to help him out, it ended up kind of, you know, being the difference in the game. I'm just still curious to see how the Packers will match up versus the Cardinals, because even though, you can always make the case, it's tough for a team like the Cardinals to beat, or really anyone in the NFL to beat a team twice in a year. I think the loss of Tyrann Mathieu really hurts the Cardinals defense because of the flexibility that he provides them, being able to play man-to-man coverage, zone coverage, the deep middle of the field if they need to, or blitz off the edge. He's so versatile, and the absence of him now due to injury, it makes me think that maybe they're a little more vulnerable than they've been in the past. I don't think you can just fill in for a guy in that position and not, you know, lose or have a little bit of drop off in your ability.
He didn't play the last game and they destroyed him. I mean, you know, that was what, 2 weeks ago? He didn't play.
That's one game.
Yeah.
I mean,
I know, but he's a great player. But to me, the thing that's shown up more with Arizona, and it showed up in that Packers game last time, is the pass rush. I mean, he'll blitz, like you guys said, and we talked about on our previews, but they're getting home. I mean, guys are getting home. Freeney and Golden starting to emerge as a good pass rusher, and Calais Campbell couldn't be blocked in that game. I mean, it to me, that's the difference with this team. I think they'll be able to get after Rodgers in this game.
I agree. They'll get after him, but something Brady said as before that needs, I'll say it again, is like they got rushing yards, whether it was late or early, they actually presented some issues and moved the chains with the running game. And I don't know why Starks isn't playing more than the other guy. Starks is dangerous. Starks is explosive. Starks can catch. The other guy, to me, Eddie Lacy's the four-minute drill guy. You just put him in when you're protecting the lead at the end and the clock's on your side. But I'd be playing Starks. They got 12 carries each. It should have been 20 for Starks and 8 for Eddie Lacy.
You know, when he made that long run, I sent out a tweet yesterday saying that was the longest run by a guard this season. I mean, he's huge. And you know, I tweeted out two pictures of him last week. I went to one of his games on the All-22 last year, in one of his games in, this year and took a picture from the back behind. He's much thicker than he was a year ago. I mean, I don't even, it's got to be 10 to 15 pounds.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Do you guys think that actually just continues the stigma with the Alabama running backs, whether it's Trent Richardson or Eddie Lacy, things not working out maybe quite the way they had hoped for? Do you think that it plays at a factor in Derrick Henry, him being a bigger back, bigger size, once he gets to the next level in the NFL?
I do.
Yeah, it reminds me, Brady, of the old days of Nebraska. You just really had to pay attention. The running backs, the line was so great and made such big holes that these guys rolled through there. And I would say that any running back on Alabama's team could rush for 100 if he gave him 20 carries. That's how I feel about it. When I was alone with this year's running back at the day after the Heisman Trophy, he's built different than the other guys now. He's tall. His lower body, he's strong as could be, of course, but his lower body is not like these guys, like these big, thick Trent Richardson body types. He's got length to him. He might be a different back than the other guys.
But he's pretty straight line now. I mean, he's
pretty
straight
up and down too.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't have a lot of wiggle to him. And, you know, in the NFL, at times, if you don't have wiggle, you got problems.
Hey, talking about wiggle, Todman and Toussaint, did you see those guys, their cutback principles? Those guys, I thought, read the scheme as good as anybody yesterday for Pittsburgh.
They grow on trees, running backs. You know that? They grow on trees. You can find them anywhere.
I mean, prove that with the Pittsburgh kids yesterday.
Yeah.
We had guys in the studio kept saying, they're just playing the pass. I said, eventually they weren't playing the pass. Go watch the tape. They were creeping down in there. Those guys were pretty damn good. And you're right. If you can find Toussaint and Todman, you can find them in other places, not the first round.
Yeah, and that's why I guess, make it a full circle coming back around to Derrick Henry. I never see him, and even, Ezekiel Elliott, I see it every once in a while. But as far as like all those running backs that are coming out in this year's draft, I never see them make the drastic backside cut that they need to, because their O lines are so dominant that the front side hole is usually there.
That's right.
And they don't have to worry about having to play against a team that's going to be a fast flow and flow over the top and get it, out leverage themselves and leave that backside cut where they have to put their foot in the ground and make a drastic jump cut or change of direction. So I feel like that's usually a big change. For whether it's Alabama running backs or any team that's more of one of the elite teams, when they're so good blocking up front, it almost plays to the detriment of that running back moving forward into the NFL, because there's so much more parity going up against defenses, and the schemes differ as well. You have to run more zone schemes. You can't run as many man blocking schemes because of that.
Dalvin Cook will be a better NFL player than Derrick Henry because he can do that. And he's not coming out, but right, he's not in this draft. He can't be. But I think Ezekiel Elliott would be a better player than Derrick Henry. I'll tell you. And we talked about him earlier in the year. And the more I've got to watch him, the more I appreciate him. Brady, is Paul Perkins is going to be a good running back in the NFL. The kid at Utah.
Paul Perkins, he'll be great. Devontae Booker out of Utah, I've been a huge fan of. That's a kid that can do it all. DeAndre Washington out of Texas Tech. A lot of people give running backs, from these spread teams. I don't know. They look at them and they say, well, they don't run the ball. They're air raid systems and all that. That's not the case. I mean, let's think about how running backs are used nowadays. They're used in the screen game. They got to be able to pass block and pass protection, right? Obviously, those are two things that you have to be able to do as a running back in the spread offenses or in some of these air raid systems. They obviously can catch out of the backfield. They can split out, play as a wide receiver as well, and then they can run the football. They don't get as many touches, so they're not going to have as much wear and tear. I'm telling you, I would look at, some of these running backs who are in the Big 12 and some of these, air raid systems, and see if I could plug them in and have them be a third down back or mix them in throughout. Maybe they're not a guy that can carry the load like an Adrian Peterson, but surely they're a guy who can go in, split reps, be able to go in and do a bunch of different things for you and probably even be a special teams player as well.
Yeah, well, we'll get to the draft stuff as this spring goes on, but the way the NFL games played, Brady, when I see a guy that has 100 receptions in college and you go look at the 100 receptions and it's not all screens and there's choice routes and there's be over routes and there's little wheel routes, those things are skill sets you're going to need in the NFL if you're going to stay on the field. Because how many times you want to empty out your – everyone would love to empty their backfield on first and 10 against regular defense, base defense. So the guy's got to be somewhat legitimate as a receiver. So the more you show me guys that have receiving skills, true receiving skills, the more I'm interested in them.
Let's spin forward to the divisional rounds before we get out of here, and we'll preview the games. We'll start with the first game, and I'm going to be at this game, is Kansas City at New England. Kansas City obviously ripped off 11 straight, looked fantastic the other day against Houston, but now you got to go to New England and get a rested team. I'll start with you, Pat. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, a couple things. You know, Belichick had said to someone I know very well that he didn't work the guys out all week. He kind of rested them all week. He said he'd never really done that before, but he thought it was the right time to do it. I think it's a really good idea. Now, those guys will be back at practice today, gnawing at the bit to go. I just think because he has Edelman and Amendola's okay and Gronk is always there, that he can overcome their inability to block that front with the fast pass, which he's great for anyway. He knows how to do it. So I just think you're going to see it. You're going to see a ton of 5-yard throws in a rhythm that's impossible to get to him. And you don't block that guy's passes. Some of these guys, you can block them, but I don't think you're going to block them. So I see Brady and company putting 28 on the board, and Kansas City without Macklin not being able to do that.
Right? Yeah, it's interesting. You guys talk about, you know, the off time that you give players, whether it's coming out of bye week or whatever. You know, you get in this routine as a player, and it almost feels like you're addicted to it at some point. I mean, you're so accustomed to it, whether as a former player in the off season. Once you get out of season, you wake up every day, your body yearning to do the same thing you're doing during the season. So you give them time off during the season. I mean, it is 100% true. These guys will be coming back, chopping at the bit, ready to get back to playing football. It's not as if they hate their day job, whatever. They will be so excited, so fired up to get back to just practicing again and getting the chance to knock up and hit up against someone and being able to compete against the guy across from them. So that's the one factor that I think I love when coaches take the time to rest their players physically and give them the opportunity to go in feeling refreshed, especially at this point in the season. But as far as this matchup's concerned, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of what Pat talked about. You're going to see them spread them out. You're going to see Tom Brady work those efficient passing games within that inside triangle, very similar to what they did versus the Seattle Seahawks with a similar kind of pass rush in last year's Super Bowl. Have a high percentage of completions, move the chains, you know, go the long, hard way, or see if you can get the Chiefs secondary to break some, you know, to miss some tackles or to break some tackles, make some big plays out of it. And it's nothing against, you know, Alex Smith and the Chiefs. They've had an amazing season. Unfortunately, they just happen to be running into, in my opinion, the best team in the AFC.
You know, Brady, you know, that whole thing about, you know, routine and addiction and everything. When I got up this morning and I wasn't there on Monday to be around you guys, I was like, what am I doing? I didn't know what I was doing.
Believe me, we had to change rules today, Pete. It felt extremely awkward for me, even though I was in the same spot not having you here.
Isn't
man
it weird though?
It was weird.
And Pat, you mentioned this a couple weeks ago on the podcast, how like when the season's over you go, okay, what do? You know what I mean? Because you get into a rhythm, and I can imagine it's the same exact way. Multiply it by 20 for players.
It is, and it's you know, I think that the value of the head coach is the guy who has a pulse of his team and knows when to push the button and when to lay off. And for Belichick, who's as brilliant as it gets, to lay off his guys. And I thought he made some personnel decisions in that final game of the year and basically surrendered the number one seed in order, because he was beat up. They were wounded, limping around. And I thought he sat some guys that might have been able to play. But by what he gave up is he's probably got to go to Denver to go to the Super Bowl. But he's going to have everyone healthy now. And so I think they're going to be full tilt, ready to go. And I'm a big James White fan. I've been a fan of his since his Wisconsin days. I think he'll be a factor in the game as well.
So we all like New England because I'm with you. I just, you know, the Vollmer injury concerns me a little bit because they might play without both their starting tackles. But in the end, I just think this is Tom Brady, and you're not going to pick against Tom Brady in New England. You're just not. Let's go to the next game, and that's the next game is Saturday night, and that's you know, Packers at Arizona. You know, for me, you can't just cast aside what I know. You know, we saw Seattle blow out Minnesota earlier in the year and then went there and struggled, but it was different. The weather conditions were different. There were players who weren't in that game who were there, you know, Harrison Smith, guys like that. So I just think this game was played 2 weeks ago. You can't just dismiss that. That was just a butt whooping to the oomph degree by Arizona, right? I mean, that it's too soon to just dismiss it.
I agree. I think that's current. First off, that game would be in anyone's scouting report in preparation for this week's game. It's so current. It's on top of what you deal with. And it was the strangest Green Bay defeat in a long time. 9 sacks in the game, 8 on Rodgers, Mr. Mobility, 8 sacks. They could not block Freeney. They couldn't block Calais Campbell, which Pete mentioned. He turns the ball over. I think Arizona totally understands how to play this. Do I think it'll be that way again? No, but I will make this reminder. The wild card weekend, the 3 teams that lost during the regular season lost again in the playoffs to the same team.
It's going to be interesting to see what changes really both offensive staffs and defensive staffs make going into this matchup. And you'd like to think that won't play a big factor, because all of a sudden what happens in the first series, each offense usually scripts their plays. They're looking at trying to figure out what the opposing defense is trying to align to certain formations or personnel groups and how they're going to play in the rest of the game. And then comes halftime. And that's where I really feel like coaching in the playoffs, it almost separates some of the best staffs and the brightest minds from the rest, because there's some teams that go into halftime and they say, okay, we can quickly identify what's working, what's not, and then they can quickly get to the things that they have in their system that they can all of a sudden adapt, make those changes in the second half, and then utilize them. And there's others that just say, well, these are the things that are working, we're going to stick with this. And they don't ever really address the things that aren't working, or they don't address the fact that a lot of those teams are going to make adjustments to stop whatever was working in the first half. And that's where you see a team stall out, or they become stagnant, because they aren't able to make those adjustments and changes at halftime, or even willing to or flexible enough at some point. So that's what I think I'm most excited about to see in not only this matchup, but other matchups where you see teams who've played each other already once this season or twice in some cases, like we saw in the wild card weekend. I'll be more curious to see the adjustments that are made late in the first half and then in the second half, to see what happens there in the second half that allows teams to pull away or a team to get back up close because of the adjustments.
What do you like?
Look, I'm taking all the home teams, so I'll go with the Cardinals in this case.
I think the Cardinals are going to find a way to win this game and get to the championship game. All right, let's go to the Sunday early game. It's Seattle, fresh off the gift that Minnesota gave them. Now they have to go back to Carolina, which is a long trip. And, I mean, you got a team in wait. Pat, I'll start with you. Who are you picking and why?
Well, I really thought long and hard about taking Carolina, but then I said I wouldn't be able to get the best of Pete if I do that, number one. And number two, the Seattle defense is what steered me right to them. 6 road games in a row, a total of 43 points. That's absurd. You go on the road for 6 games and you give up 43 points total. And they're going to have all 11 of their real starters on the field this week. They have no injuries. They're going to be fine. They dodged a bullet with Michael Bennett. So the defense to me means an awful lot in this one. As it relates to, they only have 2 missions as I see it. One is contain, and not that they're easy now, contain Cam and then double Olsen. And then I don't think they can beat you at all. And I think, I got a little nervous yesterday when Rudolph caught those 2 against Chancellor, but we've talked about Chancellor before. You're going to have to help him one way or the other. Bracket that tight end, steal the tight end. They know how to do some of those things. I see this as a very low scoring, close game. Seattle's beaten them 4 out of 5 times. They understand how to play Cam. They had a 20-7 lead in the third quarter last time. I'm going to take Seattle in this one because these guys are so experienced at playoff football. And they really, I think, and Brady said this earlier in the day, the way they got the gift or dodged the bullet probably might actually motivate them now. They had their moment of fear. I think they're going to come in not afraid, and they're going to play hard. And I think Carolina, we're going to see a little bit of, we haven't been in many playoff games.
Yeah, it's funny. Like every playoff team at some point, or I should say every Super Bowl winning team, the team that makes the Super Bowl, they usually have that like lifeline, right? And I think maybe the Seattle Seahawks just use theirs to be able to get into the next round. But I think when you're looking at this matchup, to me, I just – the teams are too similar. They're too close. So I've got to give the edge to the home team. I got to give it to the team that I feel like didn't just go through a very physical, emotional battle like the Seattle Seahawks just did in Minnesota. And Pete, I'll let you talk about the back-to-back road games, but I'm going to talk about more of the emotional, just roller coaster ride of, you know, really your season being gone and it's all but lost. And all of a sudden there's a missed field goal. You're back in it. And all those, you know, bumps and bruises don't feel as bad Sunday when you win. But I can tell you what, Monday, Tuesday, the physical matchup versus the Vikings, they will be feeling it and they will not be as fresh as the Carolina Panthers. That's why I give
you,
them
you
the
mentioned
edge.
The back-to-backers. That's always tough, but it's also not just like a back-to-backer going to the West Coast or going to the Midwest. They're going all the way across the country. That game starts early. How tough is that for a West Coast team to start a game, which is essentially 9 o'clock or whatever in the morning for them?
I mean, it all depends on the schedule of, you know, how they fly out, how many days ahead of time. You know, I think a lot of teams, like in Seattle's case, they'll go out 2 days ahead of time to help adjust to the time difference.
Yeah, they always go on Friday.
Yeah, and so that helps. That plays a part. I've always been a huge advocate of that. I remember being a part of organizations that wouldn't do that, and I felt we always felt so groggy. Everything was kind of off, and it was no wonder why you wouldn't perform as well on some of those longer trips. But you know, I definitely think there's something to that. But I think the way the Seattle travels, that'll kind of nullify the effect.
I'm concerned because it's. Yeah, I know they go out on Friday, but it's still really early. But the other side of that, then I sit there and I say, you know what? That team is so mentally tough, it's unbelievable. And I gotta give credit to Pete on that. I mean, you can see it. They take the field, and even when they're down 9-0, they obviously feel that they come back. All right, let's get to one last game because I know we gotta wrap it up. The late game, Peyton Manning back on the field. Against, we don't know if it'll be Ben Roethlisberger, but it probably will be. Who do you guys like quickly?
Yeah, I'll just say I think playing the wild card really hurt Pittsburgh. They got beat up physically, and we're holding our breath on Ben and Antonio. I think both will play. Denver's sitting home with a great defense and a quarterback that kind of showed everyone he can still do it just enough. I think Denver wins the game 27-20.
Yeah, I think it'll be a close game, in particular if Ben Roethlisberger plays. But I give, again, the advantage to the home team, the Broncos, that defense, and then Peyton back in the saddle. I think he gets the Broncos in the right position to allow them success. And let me just one quick note on Roethlisberger's shoulder. I'll be curious to see that fine line of how much he practices and how much they rest his arm to allow the inflammation to go down in that separated shoulder. That's what you're battling with, is a lot of time inflammation with the AC joint. So you'll see he'll struggle to be able to bring his arm above his shoulder, right? Like you'd raise up to throw a football because of the impact on the way he fell when Burfict sacked him. And that's just something that it takes time to heal. You can try treating it with injections to help, you know, relieve some of the inflammation or orally, whatever, as far as the, you know, anti-inflammatories you take. But in the end, on game day, you know, that him not being able to have his arm at full strength hurts their game, because that's part of the potency of that offense, right, is the ability for Ben Roethlisberger to stretch the field, make big plays to his wide receiver group. So that's going to be a huge factor.
And the sacks, man. Look, Denver can come after you like nobody, right? They're the best in the league in sacks. Ben really can't run. He can't cross the line of scrimmage and risk a brutal injury. So I say they're after him, and I don't think he's going to get as many reset plays as he usually gets.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I think Denver, and then it'll set it up for Brady and Manning for next week, and we can talk all about that next week on the Roughing the Passer podcast. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care, man. That was great.
Always fun. See you.